www.tampa.org/camping.
And you are listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater Community Conscious Radio. Hi, I'm Mary Glennie.
And I'm Arlene Engelhart. And you are listening to From a Woman's Point of View. Lots of interesting things to talk about today, Mary.
Yeah, and I really hope that people have been listening to Amy Goodman, and since, you know, she's been reporting on the climate summit, and it's been really very interesting. And she was ending today with the role of women, and but also very powerfully the role of young people. And I hope you heard the young woman from Sweden, 15 years old, saying that it's going to be impossible to solve the crisis if you don't admit there's a crisis. And the young people are telling it like it is. They realize it's their world, and it's not going to be a very good world for them if we don't get our act together and fast. But also, women, you have got to come into your power. We really need your wisdom, your intelligence, your passion. And remember, you're fighting for your children, your grandchildren. You're fighting for the seventh generation down the line. And all of it really does matter. And so, yes, I'm very excited about this show. Furious about what they're going to do to the wetlands, but we can't get into this this week. But and here, that's another area we're going to have to. We've got a 60-day, input period, and people really have to get their opinions on in there what we think is going to happen with the wetlands. It's almost stunning the amount of acreage that we could lose to development here in this state. But anyway, water is as important as air, and this is what we're talking about. But I am really excited. I was able to catch up with Jessica Mason Pico and talk about what happened, or didn't happen, you might say, with the Supreme Court on Monday. And I really was excited to be able to catch up with John Nichols and talking, yes, the big I word, the impeachment word. And I think John took it to a deep level, really discussing kind of the historical implications of impeachment and how it relates to us right now today. So I am really excited about this show. And Arlene, you look like you're furiously reading over there. Are you have anything you want to add?
Just trying to get some things posted that will give people further information on today's guests and what they're talking about.
So I really think that without further ado, I'm going to get right into Jessica Mason Pico. I am so happy to welcome back to the show our legal analyst extraordinaire, Jessica Mason Pico, who is the Vice President of Law and Courts for that just fabulous website, rewire.news, where you can go to not only learn a great deal about women's reproductive rights, but just their rights all the way around and not just for women. So, Jessica Mason Pico, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, once again, the Supreme Court gets attention, perhaps by not speaking and by not doing too much. But I must admit, I was really kind of steamed, as I know you were, when Senator Collins said, see, this is the reason I knew that Kavanaugh would not be against abortion. So, looking back to Monday in the Supreme Court, what didn't happen?
Okay, so on Monday, the Supreme Court announced that it was not going to take up two cases involving state efforts to kick Planned Parenthood out of Medicaid programs. And so your listeners may have remembered a couple years ago during the summer, there was the whole quote-unquote baby parts scandal with the Center for Medical Progress leaking these videos that turned out to be really heavily edited and were basically propaganda pieces that purported to show Planned Parenthood representatives unlawfully selling fetal tissue parts for profit. So none of that happened, but it created a big brouhaha within conservative circles enough to launch a bunch of investigations and to give, turned up no evidence of wrongdoing by Planned Parenthood, so wasted a bunch of money, and also motivated some conservative state lawmakers to try and kick them out of their Medicaid program. So Planned Parenthood sued, and lower courts had said to the states, you can't just kick Planned Parenthood out for political purposes, and those states took the case to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court didn't take them. So what that means is that these lower court decisions that said, hey, Kansas and Louisiana, because that's where these two states came from, or these two cases came from, you cannot go about kicking Planned Parenthood out of your Medicaid program the way you tried to do so. And so that's great news. There are thousands of people in Kansas and Louisiana that rely on Planned Parenthood for care and use Medicaid benefits to access that. So that is all wonderful news. But this case really has nothing to do about abortion. And so besides the fact that Planned Parenthood is one of the plaintiffs. And so the idea that Susan Collins then takes up this this sort of, as you said, you know, non-action by the court to go and crow that this means that Brett Kavanaugh is somehow not going to be a vote to overturn Roe or to roll back abortion rights is just ludicrous.
And also it's insulting because so often, you know, they're trying to pin a Planned Parenthood that all it does is abortions, when actually a great deal of what was being kind of talked about with Medicaid in this case, because Medicaid funds are not used for any abortion procedures at Planned Parenthood or anyplace else. But, you know, all the other services they do, which are so extraordinary, which are like 97% of all the work they do. And for, so Senator Collins to say that, it kind of underscores that this misinformation goes around, that's been going around forever, that Planned Parenthood is just about abortion. And so to me, it's a double whammy, and I would assume a senator is much smarter than that.
Yeah, well, and I think she is. I just think that she hopes her constituents aren't, or that they're not able to pay attention closely. And another thing about this case is it's not even really so much about Planned Parenthood, you know, not to get too in the legal weeds, but the question that the court was really asked to take up and consider is whether or not third parties like Planned Parenthood or Medicaid beneficiaries, individuals who are Medicaid recipients, can sue when there are changes to the Medicaid program. So there's this whole question of who can sue because the Medicaid statute doesn't specifically say that there are claims like this. But the courts have historically read those claims into the statute, and not just in Medicaid, in other areas of the law. So really, this was a case that was about Planned Parenthood, but it was about much more, which is, do these private right of actions for Medicaid exist? And that matters not just because of Planned Parenthood, but because we have states like, you know, Kentucky and Missouri and Arkansas that are trying to implement work requirements on Medicaid recipients. And that so far has gone against the text and the spirit of the Medicaid statute. And had conservatives been successful here, then it would have made it much more difficult for Medicaid recipients to sue and challenge conservatives who are trying to implement these kind of requirements on beneficiaries.
Yeah, I think it's really important for the listeners to realize that there were requirements put on that by the federal funds, with Medicaid going to the states, because the states will come up with all kinds of, and mainly political reasons, to either disbar someone from, you know, providing a service, or perhaps saying, well, actually, we know better than you do, and these funds, rather than being used for this, you know, which have to do with medicine, might do something very ancillary, which you have to scratch your head. And so actually there's always been a contest, kind of, hasn't it, between states and federal funding, who's going to actually be in charge of the money once it gets to the states. And so this is a pretty basic issue, and you know, to suggest that this is a, you know, a litmus test on Kavanaugh is really pretty sad. But also I'm kind of concerned because you know, most of the circuit courts agreed that Kansas and Louisiana did not have the right to do this. But I think, what did the 8th Circuit Court to actually accept this challenge as being, I don't know, I'll have you go into that. And also, I know in your article, which I was reading, that the 6th Circuit Court also is going to have a full, and why is that important? It's going to have a full court studying it, as opposed to what? Usually they only two or three actually go at it?
Yeah, so a couple things are happening. One, as you mentioned, to bring these cases back to the fight over Planned Parenthood and Medicaid funding. This fight is still live in many states. Arkansas and Missouri are two of them, but in particular Arkansas. And as you mentioned, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals said, and it is all alone in this, that individual recipients can't challenge the decision to kick Medicaid out of the Arkansas program. And so the way that that case is sort of framed up, the facts of that case are a little bit different than the ones that came before the Supreme Court, but they overlap. And they show that, like I said, this is very much a live battle, and the same is true in Ohio. Normally, when cases get appealed from federal court to the Court of Appeals, the first round of appeals is heard by only a couple judges. You know, these appellate courts have, you know, sometimes 12 to 14 judges at a time. And so to get through cases, they'll assign what's called a panel, which is just a couple of judges. And so a panel of judges had determined that Ohio could not kick Planned Parenthood out of its Medicaid program because of these propaganda videos. And the state of Ohio appealed that decision to the entire full Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. And so that matters. We're getting really inside baseball here, but that matters because under the Trump administration, the Sixth Circuit has driven hard to the right. And so there are now judges on the Sixth Circuit who would be more likely to overturn that ruling and go along with the Eighth Circuit. If that happens, then that creates enough of a disagreement, or at least it advances the disagreement in the law significantly enough to the point that the Supreme Court may at a future time take up this issue. So, you know, again, Monday's decision means simply that the court was not interested in taking those two cases at this particular time. And that's really about all that we can read into it.
And you are listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater Community Conscious Radio. And you're listening right now to Jessica Mason Piclo. Yeah, but also I'm kind of concerned because Trump and Mitch McConnell and the Federalist Society have been pushing these federal judges. And mm-hmm. I think with the Sixth and the Eighth, I think you're beginning to see some effects of some of these federal judges that have been rammed through the Senate, changing mm-hmm. the rules for their confirmation. And, you know, as Clarence Thomas said in his dissent, because he and Alito and Gorsuch, you know, wanted to take up the case, is that, well, this has only to do with Planned Parenthood. People are afraid this is political. And that mm-hmm. actually, why, my goodness, Medicaid patients would be suing all the time, say if their doctor was no longer part of the Medicaid program. And I thought, wow, I thought we are really getting into some real basic rights here, which actually are pretty darn important. And so I'm watching this and, you know, Monday, And as you and I were mentioning briefly before the interview, you know, the Supreme Court must have thought it got way too much attention, not all positive, over the summer with the confirmation. And do you think actually that might have been one reason that they decided to, you know, go by the actual law and say, no, we're not getting involved here? Do you think this is part of the pulling in of the horns just to let the smoke clear?
I do, and the thing is with Justice Thomas's dissent on Monday is I don't think he's necessarily wrong. You know, he says the court sidestepped taking the cases because it involves Planned Parenthood and is tangential to the abortion issue. And I mean, I think you can see, given Susan Collins' reaction, that there is some truth to that, and there has been a theory in the court watching circles that the Chief Justice was very upset with the Kavanaugh proceedings, and in particular the manner in which Kavanaugh conducted himself during the hearings, and is trying to pump the brakes on the court this term, in particular from taking up any of the hot button cases. And it has so many right now that it is considering. You know, in addition to these cases, the court is sitting on a couple petitions that ask whether or not sexual orientation discrimination is protected against in federal employment law. For example, and a couple abortion-related petitions. So plenty of areas for the court to weigh in on culture wars type things. And the fact that we are seeing the court take up fewer and fewer of these cases right now, but not necessarily dismiss them. Many of these petitions are still sitting there, which means that they can be taken up at a later time. So I do think that there is an effort by the Chief Justice to cool the temperature around the court right now, and in particular with so much of the attention placed on the administration and on the Mueller investigation, the court is going to be and will remain in the political crosshairs through the 2020 presidential election. So as far as Roberts is concerned, if he wants his legacy to be one that is somewhat independent of the Trump administration, this is his last moment to do so. I frankly don't think he'll be successful, but he's going to try, it looks like.
And again, we're talking to Jessica Mason Piclo, and she is a legal analyst extraordinaire, as you've just heard. And she's vice president for law and courts with Rewire.News, and you are listening to WMNF in Tampa. And, you know, Jessica, we're coming near, you know, the year's end, so to speak, and you kind of do an evaluation of really what's happening. And, I'm watching this in the hot button issue, and once again, regarding women's rights, women's autonomy. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, the State Department's asked to prepare a yearly survey of human rights, and what, they give this to the UN, they give their evaluation, and they have chosen not to, because mm-hmm. under Barack Obama, he did put women's reproductive rights and women's rights and LGBT, and under Trump, they've decided not to do this. They have some, I can't remember the title that they want to give to this vague area. And, you know, I don't know, but it seems to me I'm getting woefully tired of women's autonomy and women's essentially right to exist as an autonomous human being constantly being kicked around as a football. And tell me, did you see the fiasco show at all yesterday with Trump and Pelosi and, and Schumer and then Pence? And afterwards, Pelosi said that she felt like she had to be a mom in there. And did you watch that clown show?
I did. I think Pelosi's comment that she had to be the mom in the room was exactly right. She is fact-checking the president in real time. This is uncharted territory for, you know, our government, which historically, you know, I mean, we can talk about Congress being loud and rowdy, but really so much of our upper-tier politics is, you know, I would say very, not necessarily conservative in ideology, but sort of conservative in implementation and almost sort of prudish in the way that they engage each other. And that was not the case with this oppressor in these negotiations yesterday. The president's reaction also speaks volume to tie this to your point about women's autonomy being used as a political football. Not only was this the first time that a member of Congress had to his face really stood up to him, but we can all assume that President Trump liked it even less that it was a woman. So I anticipate that this is going to be a raucous 2 years.
And I really got a kick out of her. And she said, I do not need you to give the qualifications for my being here. And I, you know, I don't know which was worse. So many people have commented on it, but I saw an hilarious thing on YouTube, Pence sitting there and his expressions. But I shouldn't be going this far off field, but it was so funny because someone speeded up his reactions the whole time. and it was, if it was extraordinary in real time, if it's beaded up, you really do look, and you think, who is this man? And once again, you have a man that his views are so extreme about women to the point where he won't be in the room with a woman unless his wife is present. And this goes way beyond this when you're talking about women's autonomy and a reproductive rights. And so really, you know, I think that with all these chains that are being constantly put on women and having to fight constantly to keep them off, I really think it is the time of the women, don't you? It has to be.
Well, we saw this also with the Kavanaugh hearings in terms of those senators who were the most effective at not just pushing back against Kavanaugh's narrative, but really rattling him. And so, you know, we are seeing legitimate and sincere challenges to white patriarchal power, and they don't like it. I think that the folks who will be the most effective change makers as a result of that will be women, and likely women of color, too. So I think, you know, keep an eye out, for example, you know, Stacey Abrams rattled everybody, you know, in her run, and look at what the incoming, freshman Congress women from New York and Minnesota, you know, a whole crop of young, feisty women of color who are smart and determined and not going to be pushed around by the likes of, you know, Lindsey Graham.
And Jessica, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez,
she's fantastic.
And did you know with the Federalist Society, the head of the Federalist Society said he really feels that the Republicans should be very afraid of this young woman and they should take her very seriously. And I thought, and coming back to us and the Federalist Society and Kavanaugh and some of the antics that are going on right now, I think that not only the blue wave in Congress, but I really think that we really have reached a point we can't take it anymore and shouldn't take it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think a new dawn is coming, but man, it is one tough fight, you know.
It sure is. We've got some work to get there.
Okay. Well, Jessica Mason Pichler, I went a little bit afield, but I knew you'd be following all that too. So anyway, thank you so much for enlightening us what didn't happen Monday and what we should take from that. And keep up your great work and all your colleagues at the Rewire.news. Just a wonderful resource. So thank you so much for giving us all this time.
Oh, thank you so much, as always, for having me on. And if I don't talk to you soon, have a very happy new year.
You too. And I'm sure you're an avid skier or snowboarder, that you get the kind of powder you really want out there in Colorado. that's fantabulous. Okay, well, thanks so much, Jessica.
And again, that was Jessica Mason Pichler, and she's the Vice President of Law and Courts for Rewire.news.
And you have been listening to WMNF. You are listening, not have been. At least I hope you're still there. Come back, because I think you'll be interested in the next interview too. But Jessica is so if you ever want to listen to a really fun podcast and learn a lot about the legal issues that are really important, particularly to women in that week or in that time, a lawyered boom, they call it, and she and her great colleague Imanani Gandhi, they really take it on. They'll explain it, and they're fun and they're irreverent. And their language is quite appropriate most of the time, unless they're really steamed. Anyway, and so Arlene, go ahead.
We've just had several calls from listeners that have really been enjoying this and thanking us for the show. But one listener posed a question that I certainly couldn't answer, and I told him we'd get it to Jessica and take it up in a future show. And that is, if the government is going to determine what women can do with their bodies, wouldn't a woman have the right to sue the government for child support if they to carry a child?
Once the fetus is born, the interest seems to decline. That's always been a problem, but it is a problem. Control a woman's body when it seems
she particularly needs to be controlled. But raise a child, hey, you're on your own. You know, I mean, what can I say? But, yes. You know, I will ask that the next time I talk to Jessica, which she's, I tell you, she's a brilliant woman. And they're so lucky out there at Boulder that, you know, because she teaches in the law school, they're lucky because she is very, very astute. And her range of interests always tickles me. But
and support for WMNF comes from our members and Live Nation, presenting Wheels of Soul 2019, featuring Tedeschi Trucks Band, Blackberry Smoke, and Shovels and Rope. Sunday, June 30th at Al Lang Live in St. Petersburg. Get more information at Ticketmaster.com.
And then let's play this little promo, and then I want to get on to the interview with John Nichols.
WMNF, community radio. Why do you love us? WMNF is
indestructible.
Power to the people is
indestructible.
Check us out on the web at WMNF.org or call us up at the station at 813-238-8001 and keep the power in your hands.
I was able to catch up with John Nichols yesterday, and he has written several books related to or about impeachment, among many others. A man must be writing all the time and thinking. So anyway, without further ado, I want to get into this because I really think it's got some really important issues that are just so extraordinarily important. Write to us right now what it means to be a citizen of this country. So let's give a listen here. Well, I am so happy to welcome to the show a man whose writing I have admired for years. And John Nichols is a liberal progressive American journalist. He is the national affairs correspondent for The Nation, associate editor of Capital Times. He has written or co-authored many, many books, including The Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, A Field Guide to the Most Dangerous People in America, and a co-author with Robert McChesney of People Get Ready, The Fight Against and Jobless Economy and a Citizenship-Less Democracy, also The Genius of Impeachment. But the book perhaps I'm going to focus on right now is The Constitution Demands It. John wrote the foreword to this. The Constitution Demands It. The Case for the Impeachment of Donald Trump. Melville, Ohio Citizen, written by Ron Fain, John Bonifaz, and Ben Clements. So I could go on forever, John Nichols, with your accolades, and they're deserved. But we're looking right now at impeachment, and over the not just the events of last weekend, but in preparing for you, actually, I went back to an article you wrote, I think in August, for the Capital Times, in which you agreed with Congresswoman Gwen Moore from Wisconsin about the need to impeach Trump after the Charlottesville terrible riots. And I thought that your discussion of more of the historical roots of the impeachment, but particularly for referring to Barbara Jordan, I think really encapsulate this time.
I appreciate that, and I do think that that's the way to look at impeachment. We ought to see it in a historical context, and you know, sort of wrench it out of the moment that we're in, because frankly, Donald Trump wants us to live in the moment. He wants us to be constantly responding to his tweets, to you know, his outrageous behaviors, and to be so focused on that that we don't take a deep breath and look at, you know, the arc of history. If we do take that deep breath, and if we look at, you know, where we've been and where we are today, there is simply no question that Donald Trump has met the standard for impeachment. He has committed impeachable offenses. I'm not the only person saying that. Jerry Nadler, the incoming chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, has said that, you know, some of the allegations that have come out against Trump just in recent days certainly met the standard of impeachable offenses. If he was directing payments to porn stars and women with whom he allegedly had affairs before an election in order to warp what people knew about that election, and then if he was trying to cover that up, well, then you've met the standard. And what I've done repeatedly throughout this last 2 years, is to go back to those very carefully drawn articles of impeachment against Richard Nixon, as well as some other historical articles of impeachment going back even further into our history, and sought to point out the parallels to what Trump is doing. The simple fact of the matter is we have proposed the impeachment of, and in some cases advanced the impeachment of, individuals in the past for precisely what Trump is doing now. That being the case, I don't think we can morally or practically avoid the necessity of an impeachment inquiry.
Well, and as you and others point out, that really impeachment is not so much a legalistic procedure, but it's a necessary process, actually, for the Congress, particularly the House and the Senate, to evaluate the activities of the president. And is he doing activities that the Constitution could not tolerate? And so we're in a kind of a gray area here that's very political. And it doesn't have to be a crime, even though the term is high crimes. And I think your reference to a real, almost heroine of mine, the late Barbara Jordan, I thought that was brilliant when actually she was opening it with Nixon. You said that you compared so much to Watergate. And could you go through a little bit of that? Because I think in a way she nailed it.
Mm-hmm. I think she did. And look, this is the way to kind of think about this. Impeachment is not sufficiently discussed, or frankly sufficiently taught, in our civics classes. It's a part of the Constitution that is there, but people go over it very quickly, and they tend to view it as a third rail, as something that you would only use in the worst of emergencies, and basically try to avoid. And that's diminishing it in the worst of ways. The fact is that impeachment should be understood and can be understood as an extension of the system of checks and balances. It is, the tool by which we assure that the separation of powers is a real one, not an imbalance that gives immense power to the executive and very little power to anybody else. And so what Barbara Jordan did back during the Watergate era was something very, very important. When they were beginning the House Judiciary Committee hearing on impeachment, or on the possibility of impeachment, and on some of the votes on articles of impeachment, she gave a brilliant speech in which she said, look, it's important to understand that when the Constitution was written, it didn't think about people like her. Or at least it didn't show a lot of respect for people like her, because she was an African-American woman. And the Constitution was drawn up in 1787 by people who permitted slavery and permitted the denial of the franchise, denial of basic rights to women. Now, it may have used arcane language, it may have avoided some topics, but the fact of the matter is that was reality at the founding of the American experiment. Instead of suggesting that somehow she wasn't a part of it. However, what Jordan said was that the great genius of the American experiment was that a place had been made, that through immense struggle by people of color, by women, by supporters of abolition, by supporters of women's suffrage and voting rights and a host of other advances, the United States had gotten to a point where Barbara Jordan, as an African-American woman, was sitting on the House Judiciary Committee preparing to engage in a process of holding the most powerful man in the world, the President of the United States, Richard Nixon, to account for high crimes and misdemeanors. It was a beautiful way to do two things. One, to sum up some of the progress that the United States has made. Obviously, we haven't gotten all the way to where we need to be, but to signal that this country has progressed and has begun to realize some of its smoothly democratic promise. At the same time, she was rooting her presence there in history and in saying, while there were certainly horrible gaps in the realization of the promise of the American experiment at its beginning, there were also some essential understandings, and that was that the Congress had to have the ability to check and balance the executive. And she was putting herself in the thick of this, and then saying this beautiful concept that, you know, she was fully prepared. She was fully prepared to, you know, like, take on that cloak of responsibility and to use this remarkable tool, the process of impeachment, to hold a president to account. It was, you know, it's simply no question. It's one of the great speeches ever delivered in the Congress of the United States. And I think it had a very powerful impact, because my sense is that it framed the thinking of members of that committee at that moment in 1974. Well, it was a process, 73 into 74, but at that key moment. And I think it actually influenced not just her fellow Democrats, but some Republicans to take more seriously what was going on there. And I would just close off by saying that if indeed we get to an impeachment moment as regards Donald Trump, I think we should fully expect and obviously keep an eye out for those statements by members of Congress, younger members of Congress, newer members of Congress in this era, that might, as Barbara Jordan did in her time, frame the debate, frame the discussion in a way that would influence not just members of Congress, but the American people to have a broader, deeper respect for this process. That's my expectation. And that expectation leads me not to dismiss the prospect of impeachment, but to see it as something that is very real and very possible, and that, yes, it may have attendant divisions and disruptions, and people may get angry with one another. You'll see some elements of the politics of it all. But you will also, I would argue, see that potential for a broader, deeper understanding that does draw in some conservatives and some Republicans.
And you are listening to WMNF Tampa, and this is John Nichols.
Those who are not, you know, so wholly at odds with the American experiment that they would put a loyalty to Donald Trump ahead of a loyalty to their country.
Well, I think, and again, we're talking to John Nichols, and as you can see, he's quite an expert, really, on constitutional process, historical process, and impeachment. You know, I guess that's the hopes I really have for this, because I've been rereading again Watergate, and as you point out, and others also point out, that, you know, Rodino with Watergate did things right. you know, he realized you had to get a consensus, and, you know, that he did that by the time Nixon resigned. And right now, that's unimaginable that Trump or a similar type president would resign with the kind of conditions we have now. And I think that Nadler really kind of made the point that, yes, right now, these are impeachable offenses, but impeachable offenses does not mean you're going to pursue impeachment. And I think it will take a depth of understanding, but also a loyalty to the oath they take to the Constitution and the American people, to actually come to a consensus. And a basic question is, Trump doing activities that the Constitution will not tolerate? And I think that, and I don't think there's ever been a time to me that this country has needed more for all of us to go deeper, understand the roots of impeachment and why Mason and others considered it absolutely essential, not some radical concept, but they saw as inevitable that somebody would take advantage of this and by deception and lying use the presidency as a despot. And so, you know, to me, it requires us to go down and use what we believe about this country. And I can't think of a time, actually. To me, Trump wouldn't be there if our situation hadn't gotten to this point that we need to go at this level.
Well, I think you're exactly right. This is an unsettling moment because we see things happening that we know are wrong, that we know are out of sync. And again, that's why the historical perspective is so important. It's a way of saying, you know, let's look back at Watergate. Let's look back at other accountability moments in our history and ask ourselves, you know, what did they do then? Why aren't we doing it now? And the simple fact of the matter is that Donald Trump has transgressed in ways that, you know, literally parallel impeachments of the past. And not just impeachments, by the way, for the presidency. It's important to understand that the power of impeachment extends to all sorts of federal appointees, to federal officials. The vice president can be impeached. Members of the Supreme Court could be impeached. Federal judges can be impeached. I mean, it's a relatively broad power. And in past impeachments, I mean, going back to the founding of the country, you have had people removed for being unstable, for literally being so irresponsible, so reckless in their management of their positions that it is the determination of the House that they should be impeached and of the Senate that they should be removed. And I think that one of the gaps in our discussion about impeachment is that many people think you really do have to have a crime, that you have to have evidence of, you know, some horrific wrongdoing. It's a misreading of that term, high crimes and misdemeanors. High crimes and misdemeanors is a relatively ancient term, certainly an older term, which is imported from outside the United States, going back, you know, into the British system, and even to some extent beyond that, if you trace the derivation of the word impeach, it goes back to the French word empêcher. And what you learn is that the concept of impeachment has historically been about impeding, that's, you know, to impeach, is to slowing down, restricting the sovereign, the powerful figure, the president or the king in the past. And so you don't necessarily have to have a traditional crime, you know, a murder, a robbery. You can also have actions that are fully at odds with the Constitution, fully at odds with the good governance and you know, reasonable leadership of the Republic. And if you want to understand it in the clearest of ways, one way you might do it is to suggest that these high crimes and misdemeanors we discuss in the Constitution are, in fact, high crimes and misdemeanors against the Constitution itself, against the country itself. And so, you know, kind of pull yourself out of that traditional legal framework and come into the deeper, richer constitutional framework, it starts to make sense. And certainly obstruction of justice by the most powerful man in the world, the President of the United States, that would meet the standard of a high crime. Using your office as President of the United States to prevent justice is a, you know, really a abandonment of the basic duties of the presidency. So there you have what could certainly be seen as and understood as a high crime. Now the misdemeanors, you know, these are perhaps pettier actions. You know, the lying, frankly. Now I'm not saying that lying is a petty action per se, but one that might not, you know, meet that full standard of, say, obstruction of justice or conspiracies, but simply lying to the American people, simply being at odds with the common good to such a fundamental level that, for instance, after the Charlottesville killing, murder, and the violence in Charlottesville, to suggest there are good people on both sides, that is a failure of leadership. It is a severe failure of leadership. Now, there may be many people who say, well, that's not impeachable, and I, you know, that's a debatable point. People can take their sides on it. But there are responsible members of Congress, people like Congressman Cohen from Tennessee, one of the key figures on the Judiciary Committee, who have said quite bluntly, and I think appropriately, that the president's statements and actions after what happened in Charlottesville do demand an impeachment inquiry. And so, again, that's where we start to understand this broad term, high crimes and misdemeanors, in the context of the Constitution.
And you're listening to John Nichols on WMNF Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater. Let's continue. Yeah, and actually, in their book, The Constitution Demands It, The Impeachment of Donald Trump, I believe the authors found eight classic areas where it's impeachable offenses and accepting illegal payments from foreign governments, using government agents, you know, to persecute political enemies, obstructing justice, you know, attacking the freedom of the press. But, and as you just said, I think that really, you know, so many times with all of the lying and like the temper tantrum we witnessed yesterday with Pelosi and Schumer and Pence, that more and more you're really aware that you might not be able to really articulate it, but you think that the president, a president shouldn't act this way. And then you go a little deeper, and then you really realize, you really start really thinking about the meaning of the structure, how, you know, the framers set up our government. And you really take seriously, you know, the president's oath to faithfully execute and uphold the laws of the United States. And the president is not a king, he's not royalty. But in a sense, he really reflects the continuum, if you will, of that structure. And Donald Trump is not giving any, to me at least, confidence that he is doing that or is even attempting to do that. And once again, I think it's an unfortunate circumstance, but it's absolutely essential that I think we go into these areas of what this country is in order to resolve it. But I'm hoping that we can.
Well, I think that we can. And this is really one of the most important aspects of the discussion. I'm so glad you turned toward it. Look, we wrestle with these issues, and we should wrestle with these issues. Impeachment is a serious matter. It's not one to be taken casually, but it's also not one to be avoided. You know, look, when you impeach a president of the United States, you are saying that the results of an election, even an election in which that president lost the popular vote, although that can be taken into account, certainly, as one understanding and element of things. But you are talking about undoing the results of an election, saying that someone who was put in a position, president or vice president, should be removed before they finish their term. That's a big deal in a country where we have elections and we take this for these processes seriously. That's not something to do casually. However, the founders understood very, very clearly that we did not elect a king for 4 years. We didn't give someone monarchical control over the country for 4 years simply as a result of an election. They still had to obey the rule of law, the Constitution. They had to, whoever became president or vice president, had to maintain some, you know, deep loyalty to the basic concepts of the American experiment. And so if we wrestle with it in that way, if we understand that pull between respect for the results of an election and an understanding that respect for the results of the election does not merely extend to the great mass of American people or to the Congress, it also extends to the person who has taken office, i.e. the president himself must respect the process. And if he does not, as I do believe Donald Trump is a classic example of this, if he does not respect the process, if he does not respect his place in it, then he is not respecting the rule of law. He's not respecting the Constitution, the separation of powers, the basic concepts of checks and balances. And if he's at odds with that in a lawless, irresponsible, destructive way, then it's entirely appropriate to talk about impeachment. And, frankly, if we discuss it in this manner, if we're realistic about it and open and thorough, I think you can attract broad support. I am not one of those who believes that that this is necessarily a constitutional crisis. My argument would be that we have a constitutional crisis already. Donald Trump is governing in ways that are fundamentally inappropriate, irresponsible, destructive. And so the response to the constitutional crisis, the cure, if you will, is impeachment. It's at the very least an impeachment inquiry, where you examine whether impeachable offenses have occurred. That's generally how it begins. That's how Rodino did it back in the 70s. And in that process, if you determine, as a judiciary committee in the House, that impeachable offenses have occurred, you write articles of impeachment. The committee advances those articles of impeachment, hopefully with bipartisan support, knowing that some Republicans will never go along with it, but hoping that there may be individual Republicans who will step up and do the right thing, as happened in the Watergate inquiry. And then you get into the most interesting part of impeachment. Impeachment is a process. It begins in the House. It's completed in the Senate. It's very, very hard to get the sufficient level of support in the Senate to actually impeach someone. No president has ever been, you've had the impeachment in the House, but the trial and removal in the Senate, to complete the process and actually take the president out of office, this has not ever occurred. Could it occur with Trump? Well, perhaps. If the information that comes out of the Mueller inquiry and other information that comes forward is certainly within the broad discussion. It's something that you could imagine. But here's where you get to the deeper part of it. Often, impeachment is simply a way of the Congress, the House in this case, saying that it's serious about these matters. And by advancing the process to a certain point, you force a president, a sitting president, to consider his actions, his circumstance. In the case of Richard Nixon, he was not impeached. And again, we're talking about a process here. He was the subject of articles of impeachment that were approved by the House Judiciary Committee. But it never even got to the full House. And Nixon chose to stand down. He chose to leave the presidency. I think with a character like Donald Trump, it is reasonable to suggest, even as self-absorbed and bizarre a figure as he can be, that you might see a choice to stand down. Remember, we have had a number of officials stand down in the face of, what would clearly be an impeachment. So it is reasonable to suggest that simply beginning the process begins an accountability moment that can have one of three impacts. First, completion of the process, one way or the other, ultimately a Senate trial and vote. Two, a decision by the individual who is targeted with a impeachable offense, targeted for impeachable offenses, facing articles of impeachment, that the individual might choose to leave office rather than face accountability, might hope for a pardon from a vice president or whoever succeeds. And then there's a third element, and one that we've seen when I wrote a book about a decade ago on impeachment, cases where the threat of impeachment clearly caused presidents to change their approach and to stop pushing an initiative, stop doing something, because they didn't want to face that constitutional crisis moment, that threat. And you saw it in some cases. There was, frankly, at a point in the early 1950s, Harry Truman faced a real discussion in the House about impeachment because of his response to a steel strike. It's what now might seem a distant element of history, but it was clearly a overreach by the executive, and the push and pull ultimately ended up in the courts. And at a key point, Truman stood back. He stood down, changing policies, accepting the will of the courts, frankly. And what I would suggest to you is those are all three of those possible responses. The actual removal of the president by the Senate, a choice to quit by the president, or a choice to, really to become more responsible, to alter approaches and policies. All of those are potential playouts of an impeachment process, and all of them are reasons why we, the people, should be comfortable with impeachment. because it actually is a tool that can produce these results.
Very well
and
spoken.
You have been listening to John Nichols, very erudite, and he knows a great deal about impeachment. So, Arlene, do you have anything quickly to say in the few seconds we have left?
I was just going to say, John Nichols of The Nation, I posted his most recent article on our Facebook page, as well as Jessica Mason Peeklo's most recent article. So if you want to check them out, you can. You can also go to our page on the WMNF.org and put in the date, today's date, and you can re-listen to the show or listen if you weren't able to catch all of it.
So, opportunity for some serious civic responsibility, people. And you have been listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater, Community Conscious Radio. This has been From a Woman's Point of View. Just keep it tuned here the whole time. And so, at the bottom line, let's try and make this a better world.